Good morning. My name is Susan, and I'll be reading today from the Washington Post. It is Monday, April 6th. Surprising links between autism, Alzheimer's could change how we treat both. The idea that two conditions at opposite ends of life might be biologically linked is beginning to upend long-standing assumptions in brain science, blurring a divide that has shaped the field. Joseph Buxbaum was initially unconvinced. When early hints of a connection between autism and Alzheimer's began to appear in the medical literature a few years ago, they struck him as implausible. One, a condition of early brain development. The other, driving decline in old age. But the signals kept accumulating, and over time, his skepticism gave way to a new line of inquiry that could transform scientists' understanding of the two diseases. Quote, "I came to this kicking and screaming. I just didn't want to believe it," said Buxbaum, a professor of psychiatry, neuroscience, and genetics, genomic sciences at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Autism has long been treated almost exclusively as a childhood condition, with little attention paid to how it evolves with age. First, formally recognized as a distinct diagnosis in 1980, it went largely unidentified in older generations. Only recently, as awareness grew and the first large diagnosed cohort reaches middle age, have researchers begun to study autistic adults in later life. The data remains sparse. An analysis published last year found that just a tiny fraction of the more than 40,000 autism papers published between 1980 and 2021 included people over 50. But the number of studies about aging with autism is growing rapidly. Advances in brain imaging, DNA sequencing, and molecular biology are revealing remarkable overlaps between autism and Alzheimer's, scientists say, in genes, in neural circuitry, even in patterns of disease. The idea that two conditions at opposite ends of life might be biologically linked is beginning to upend long-standing assumptions in brain science, blurring a divide that has shaped the field for decades. Now, some researchers have begun to see the two as intertwined, that understanding Alzheimer's may require looking back to how the brain develops, and that insights into autism might, in turn, reshape how we understand Alzheimer's itself. Much of the research is still early, and in some cases conflicting and speculative, and it does not yet show that autism and Alzheimer's are part of a single biological continuum. But the implications are profound. Both conditions remain mysterious and difficult to treat, and studying them together may open new paths for intervention. Quote, "There are strong indications that something is going on, that the traditional differences demarcate neurodevelopment versus neurodegeneration may be fairly artificial when it comes to biology," said Andy Shai, chief science officer of Autism Speaks, an advocacy group that funds research and is increasingly focused on this emerging area. Separated by decades, both autism and Alzheimer's take root in the same living circuitry. The human brain, a network of billions of neurons and trillions of synapses, constantly wiring and rewiring itself over a lifetime. In one, those connections form differently. In the other, they slowly come undone. The connection first drew attention in the late 1990s to early 2000s, with unsettling findings, case reports of autistic adults developing dementia at a young age, followed more recently by larger population-level studies suggesting elevated risk for this particular group. Hard numbers are elusive. Many people now over 65 were never identified, making it difficult to estimate how many are on the spectrum. But if prevalence mirrors that seen in children, roughly 1 in 31 researchers say that the number could be as high as 1.97 million. And with 1 out of 9 Americans that age with Alzheimer's, the overlap could be roughly 220,000 people. Brian Lee, an epidemiologist at Drexel University, pointed to a 2021 analysis of Medicaid records published in autism research, which found that people with autism were about 2.6 times more likely to be diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's and related dementias compared with the general population. The work was replicated in 2025 in a JAMA research letter that reached similar findings using Medicaid and Medicare data. Autism's links to other brain disorders may extend beyond Alzheimer's, with some studies pointing to a higher risk of Parkinson's disease, a neurodegenerative disorder that affects movement, causing tremors stiffness, and slowed motion. That work has led to a cascade of questions. Some are more practical, focused on individuals' health over a lifetime. Do communication barriers make it harder to receive adequate medical attention? Are routines around exercise different? What are the long-term effects of medication? And could coordination challenges lead to more head injuries? Alongside all of this is another factor, higher lifetime stress. The idea is that autism as a condition leads to lifestyle changes that might predispose neurodegeneration, Lee said. But health habits and environment alone do not seem to explain the pattern. Increasingly, researchers are finding that the overlap runs deeper into the biology itself. Nowhere is the overlap between autism and Alzheimer's more apparent, nor more concrete than in the growing list of shared genes. A 2025 review published in the International Journal of Molecular Sciences identified at least 148 genes in common, many of them tied to the same fundamental processes that shape and sustain the brain over time. The list of shared genes is long and still growing. MECP2, ADNP, GRIN2B, SCN2A, NLGN, CNTNAP2. Many of them are deeply involved in how brain cells connect, signal, and adapt over time. Not all of their functions are fully understood, but taken together, they point to a common thread. Changes in the number, quality, and placement of synapses, the junctions where neurons communicate, may shape how minds take form and, later, unravel. Among the common gene is SHANK3, one of the most well-known in autism. In autism, mutations in what we'll call SHANK3, which encodes a protein of the same name that acts as a kind of structural framework at synapses, helping neurons communicate, can disrupt those connections early in development, altering how neural circuits are built. In Alzheimer's, levels of the same protein have been found to decline as the disease progresses, a shift that is associated with the gradual loss of connections. Buxbaum, who has spent decades studying Alzheimer's, is probing this overlap directly. In his lab, mice engineered with SHANK3 mutations and autism-like characteristics are trained to navigate mazes, first to learn a location, then to relearn it after the rules change. As they age, the mice struggle to adapt, taking longer to relearn the task. The deficits echo a hallmark of Alzheimer's: impaired cognitive flexibility. Yet the mice present a paradox. Despite these impairments, they are unusually resistant to developing full-blown dementia-like pathology. So you have to double or triple down in introducing bad things into the mouse brain to even get something that looks like Alzheimer's in a mouse, Buxbaum had said. While mouse brains are commonly studied in neuroscience, they still are critically different from human brains in a way that limits how experiments translate to people. But that resistance in mice may offer important clues. If researchers can understand what protects mouse brains, they may uncover mechanisms that could only one day be harnessed for humans. Even at rest, the brain is busy and messy. Packed with roughly 170 billion cells, it is constantly generating waste that must be cleared away to keep its circuits running. Many of the shared genes between autism and Alzheimer's point to a single system, cellular housekeeping. Roughly half are linked to the MTOR pathway, which controls autophagy, the process by which cells clear debris, recycle components, and remove toxic proteins. When that system fails, the profound consequences unfold slowly. Waste accumulates. Proteins misfold. Communication between neurons begins to break down. Over time, researchers theorize these disruptions could both help alter brain development and lead to the kind of degeneration seen in Alzheimer's. In a largely interpretive paper published in January in Frontiers in Neuroscience, researchers described possible commonalities in MRI findings between autism and Alzheimer's, particularly involving the glymphatic system, a brain-wide network that helps clear metabolic waste, especially during sleep. Patterns such as enlarged spaces around blood vessels and increased fluid around the brain were reported in both conditions. Though these findings are preliminary, The work remains largely hypothesis-generating. While it may point to shared biological pathways, it does not establish a direct link between the two conditions. William Phillips, a nuclear medicine physician at UT Health San Antonio, who was an author of the study, said the findings caught his attention because the brain's cleanup system is closely linked to smell. In Alzheimer's, people often lose their sense of smell before memory problems begin. And although smell issues have been reported in autism, they have largely been dismissed as a sensory quirk rather than as a possible clue to brain health. By concentrating on these mechanisms, the authors wrote, scientists might be able to develop, quote, integrated treatment strategies that address both disorders simultaneously, ultimately improving the quality of life for affected individuals. With the rise of brain imaging, researchers can now watch these conditions unfold in living brains, and the patterns are beginning to look unexpectedly similar. For years, research in both autism and Alzheimer's focused on individual regions, which parts were larger or smaller, more or less active. Scientists were intrigued, for example, that Alzheimer's is associated with the shrinking of a brain region known as the amygdala, a structure involved in emotion, fear, and social processing. In autism, the amygdala is often enlarged, although the findings have varied by age and study design. Increasingly, though, attention has shifted to the connections between those regions, the networks that allow the brain to function as an integrated whole. In two fields that have long operated separately, researchers have, in effect, converged on the same idea. In autism, findings presented last year at the American Neuropsychiatric Association's annual conference suggest that the density and strength of synaptic connections may correlate with functioning. In some cases, more robust connectivity is associated with better functioning in daily life. In Alzheimer's, by contrast, the loss of those same connections correlates very strongly with cognitive decline. And some believe it may be a better anatomical correlate than the buildup of amyloid plaques or tangles of a protein known as tau, long considered the disease's defining indicator. How those brain connections evolved over time and what that might reveal about aging and autism and its potential links to Alzheimer's is now becoming a central question, one that researchers like B. Blair Braden have begun to explore. Braden directs the Autism and Brain Aging Laboratory at Arizona State University and has spent more than a decade recruiting dozens of adults with autism from the greater Phoenix area, asking them to return again and again for brain scans. Her first major paper on the subject, which was published in 2022, pointed to changes in the hippocampus, a region critical for memory that shrinks with age in both autistic and non-autistic adults, but to a more severe extent and earlier for those with autism. Braden has been struck by how the brain scans seem to tell a similar story to the genetic and molecular work. Quote, it's kind of amazing to see how the results are coming together, end quote. What's emerging from this and other research labs is not just a shift in thinking, but the early outlines of new treatments. Braden's work, along with findings from other labs, points to a reorientation for Alzheimer's treatments, away from amyloid and tau alone, and towards synapses and connectivity as potential targets. Meanwhile, a separate line of research points back to the other way. Tau, a hallmark of Alzheimer's, may also play a role in autism. In San Francisco, scientists at the Gladstone Institutes reported in the journal Neuron in 2020 that they were able to prevent core autism symptoms in mice that modeled some of the more severe presentations of the condition by decreasing levels of tau by 50%. Follow-up studies that will be published shortly showed that this effect was not temporary, but lasted for a lifetime, said Lennart Mook, the lead author of the study and neuroscience professor at the University of California in San Francisco. In the brain, tau acts as a kind of regulator of what Mook calls brain cell excitability. Reducing it, he said, may help the brain cool off or suppress a pathway that is overactive and creates abnormal brain connections. Imagine an orchestra, he said. You want everyone to play in harmony. said Milk, director of the Gladstone Institute of Neurological Disease. If the conductor fails, there's dysregulation. The work ahead in both autism and Alzheimer's, he said, is learning how to bring that harmony back. In our second article, we focus on Artemis II's moonbound astronauts capture Earth's brilliant blue beauty as they leave it behind. Cape Canaveral, Florida. The Artemis II astronauts have captured our blue planet's brilliant beauty as they zoom ever closer to the moon. NASA released the crew's first downlinked images on Friday, 1.5 days into the first astronaut moonshot in more than half a century. The first photo, taken by Commander Reed Wiseman, shows a curved slice of Earth in one of the capsule's windows. The second shows the entire globe with the oceans topped by swirling white tendrils of clouds. A green aurora even glows, according to NASA. Quote, it's just great to think that with the exception of our four friends, all of us are represented in this image, said NASA's Lakeisha Hawkins, an exploration systems leader. She added, the mission is going well. As of late Friday afternoon, Wiseman and his crew were more than 110,000 miles or 180,000 kilometers from Earth and were quickly gaining on the moon with another 150,000 miles or 240,000 kilometers to go. They should reach their destination today, Monday. The three Americans and one Canadian will swing around the moon in their Orion capsule. They will hang a U-turn and then head straight back home without stopping. They fired Orion's main engine Thursday night that set them on their course. After mission control shifted the position of their capsule, the entire Earth, complete with northern lights, filled their windows. Quote, it was the most spectacular moment and it paused all four of us in our tracks, Wiseman said in a TV interview. They are the first lunar travelers since Apollo 17 in 1972. The Associated Press Health and Science Department received support from Howard Hughes Medical Institute's Department of Science Education and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The AP is solely responsible for all of this content. On Easter, Pope Leo delivers a commanding message of peace to a world at war. Pope Leo used his first Easter speech Sunday to deliver a resounding call for peace in times of renewed war, declaring, quote, let those who have weapons lay them down, end quote. Let those who have the power to unleash wars choose peace, Leo said. Not a peace imposed by force, but through dialogue. Not with the desire to dominate others, but to encounter them. We are growing accustomed to violence, resigning ourselves to it, and becoming indifferent. Indifferent to the deaths of thousands of people. The Chicago-born leader of 1.4 billion Catholics has amped up his vocal campaign to denounce violence in the Middle East, while also seeming to push back against efforts by the Trump administration and its allies to harness religion and God in their framing of politics and war. This Easter is seen as especially portentous for the Vatican and the world's largest Christian faith. Pope Francis died a day after greeting the crowds in St. Peter's Square on Easter of last year. And a new American pope is now navigating a global landscape upended by a White House that is unleashing military might overseas while embracing a nativist agenda at home, in words and deeds often seen by the Vatican as challenging the tenets of Catholicism. Speaking from a balcony above the square on Sunday to a throng of faithful in the Urbi et Orbi blessing, a key papal speech to the city of Rome and the world, Leo repeated words from Francis's final Easter speech. Quote, what a great thirst for death, for killing, we witness each day in the many conflicts raging in different parts of the world, end quote. Invocations of God by the Trump administration to defend the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran have alarmed the Vatican, and Leo has grown blunter in pushing back against suggestions that divine providence supports the use of force or violence, as when Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth asked God to give U.S. troops attacking Iran overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. President Donald Trump, in a social media post Saturday, again invoked God while reiterating the ultimatum for Iran to make a deal or open the Strait of Hormuz. Time is running out, 48 hours before all hell will rain down on them. Glory be to God. On Palm Sunday, Leo said that God does not listen to the prayers of those who wage war. He quoted Isaiah 1:15. Quote, even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood, end quote. On Easter Sunday, Leo called Jesus the victorious king, citing his power of dialogue and peace as true strength. The Pope did not mention any antagonist by name. but as he has done repeatedly since the start of the U.S. Israeli assault on Iran, he framed the genuine nature of divinity as one that wholly rejects war. The power with which Christ rose is entirely nonviolent, Leo said. Earlier on Sunday, during his homily outside St. Peter's Basilica and before sprays of ornately arranged flowers, during a multilingual mass, Leo paid homage to Francis in a largely uplifting message, speaking of a, quote, hope that never fails, end quote. He also warned against partisan selfishness and a lack of attention given to the most vulnerable. We see it in violence, in the wounds of the world, and the cry of pain that rises from every corner because of the abuses that crush the weakest among us, he said, because of the idolatry of profit that plunders the earth's resources, because of the violence of war that kills and destroys. Leo's comments were delivered during a Holy Week in which the 70-year-old pontiff has again shown that in style, at least, he is a very different leader than his predecessor, despite their broadly similar views on major topics. Where Francis was off the cuff, unpredictable, and prone to headline-making drama, Leo has emerged as the quiet pope, more subdued, circumspect, and, in many ways, traditional. On Holy Thursday, for instance, Leo returned to the papal tradition of washing the feet of 12 priests during a ceremonial mass at the Basilica of St. John Lateran, one of the four major papal cathedrals in and around Rome. The event harked back to old times at the Vatican after years in which Francis broke norms by washing the feet of inmates, including women and Muslims, at area prisons. During Holy Week, Leo put his stamp on the papacy in other ways. On Friday night, at a solemn torchlit spectacle for 30,000 faithful near Rome's Colosseum, he became the first pope since John Paul II to carry a cross through all 14 stations of the cross. Doing so, he said, as an invitation to all, quote, people of goodwill, end quote, to be, quote, bearers of peace, end quote. In his Easter Vigil homily on Saturday evening, he spoke again of the Easter gifts of harmony and peace and of driving out hatred. On Sunday, he sang out verses during Mass, a departure from the more tone-deaf Francis. At the end of his speech, Leo issued Easter greetings in 10 languages, including Arabic, Chinese, and Latin. He also announced a vigil for Saturday to pray for peace in a world ravaged by war. As his first year draws to a close, Leo's early papacy is being defined in many ways by his response to the leader of his homeland, Trump. Expressing alarm at polarization, Leo stated near the outset of his papacy that he would seek to avoid partisan politics and not promote polarization in the church. Generally, he's been very careful in his language, for the most part, avoiding direct criticism of the Trump administration or the United States, and allowing listeners to parse or debate his true meaning. He has left more overt criticism of the administration to U.S. bishops, considered close to him, and other senior proxies. Archbishop Timothy Broglio, who heads the Catholic Archdiocese for the Military Services USA, told CBS News in an interview taped on Thursday that the war in Iran would not be justified under the just war theory applied by the Catholic Church, arguing that while Iran may have posed a threat with nuclear arms, the U.S. is compensating for a threat before the threat is actually realized. Quote, the Lord Jesus certainly brought a message of peace, and also I think war is always a last resort, he said in the segment that aired on Sunday. He noted that the Trump administration may have information that led them to think that that was the only choice they had. I'm not making a judgment about that because I really don't know. But I do think that it's hard to cast this war, you know, as something that would be sponsored by the Lord. Last year, Leo described the Trump's administration immigration crackdown as inhumane. In other gesture, on July 4th, he plans to visit Lampedusa, an Italian island known as the first stop for desperate refugees from the North African coast attempting to enter Europe. Now the Iran war has raised the stakes. Leo spoke Friday with Israeli President Isaac Herzog. A Vatican readout of the call said the Pope reiterated the need for dialogue and focus on the importance of protecting the civilian population and promoting respect for international and humanitarian law. During his Holy Thursday homily, Leo said, we tend to consider ourselves powerful when we dominate victorious, when we destroy our equals, great when we are feared. In contrast, as true God and true man, Christ offers us the example of self-giving, service, and love. On Friday night, as Leo carried a cross, a solemn meditation was read out. Quote, every person in authority will have to answer to God for the way that they exercise their power, the power to judge, the power to start or end a war, the power to instill violence or peace, end quote. Leo's approach to speak softly but carry a big moral stick has fans and detractors. Alicia Antonelli, 57, a Rome doctor who attended the Good Friday event at the Colosseum, called Leo tepid compared to the more outspoken Francis, who once indirectly described Trump as not Christian. He can't be compared to John Paul II, or Francis for that matter, Antonelli said, but I think he's doing his best. Her friend, Sonia Brunetti, 58, who joined her at the event, said she couldn't disagree more. For almost a year now, he's been putting Christ back at the center and trusting everything to him, even in the current situation. I just love him, Brunetti said. She added, he's preaching peace like a pope ought to, not about standing up to Trump. But he has indeed been quite stern by talking about blood-drenched hands and couldn't care less about whom he is facing. He speaks straighter than Francis, saying, you can't tell yourself a Catholic. You can't call yourself a Catholic if your hands are stained with blood. When I heard him say that, I thought to myself, we've got a great pope on our hands. Leaves are emerging early after record warm March. After the most unusually warm month on record across the United States, the trees and flowers have taken notice. Temperatures were a whopping 7 degrees above average across the country during March, and it was shockingly toasty in the West, where temperatures were summer-like. That means flowers are blooming in the mid-Atlantic and central states, and you may notice pollen wafting through the air, depending upon where you live. According to data from the USA National Phenology Network, also known as USANPN, leaves have emerged 2 to 4 weeks earlier than normal in many central and western states, breaking records, with about 190 million people across the country so far experiencing an early start to spring based on the behavior of lilac and honeysuckle. Teresa Crimmins, director of USANPN, said that there have been some crazy early starts to spring in the West, with reports of flowering oak trees in western Oregon, lilac leaves emerging in south-central Wyoming, and flowering shrubs near Denver. With cherry blossoms now in full bloom in D.C., many northern cities from Detroit to New York and Boston are on the verge of seeing spring leaves and increasing seasonal allergies. Meteorological spring started on March 1st. The astronomical season started March 20th. But there's a third option. The season is decreed by the plants. They don't follow any calendar and instead leaf out when it's warm enough. The first emergence of leaves can be estimated by temperatures since the start of the year. A certain amount of warmth needs to accumulate before the leaves appear. This warmth is typically measured through a metric called growing degree days. In Florida, first leaf typically happens in mid to late January. Meanwhile, it usually takes until mid to late April in Maine. This season, leaves have popped out earlier than normal across wide swaths of the country, including the West, the Rockies, the Plains, and the Midwest, consistent with very unusual March heat. Leaf out occurred at least 2 weeks earlier than normal in parts of 14 states, considering statewide medians. These states include Wyoming, Colorado, Nebraska, Montana, Idaho, Kansas, Oregon, Nevada, South Dakota, Utah, Ohio, Indiana, Iowa, and Illinois. That list will probably soon grow to include North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. It was the earliest leaf out on record near the Rocky Mountains and in parts of the Central Plains from Kansas to South Dakota, where leaves locally emerged 30 to 50 days earlier than normal, as well as in the section of the Gulf Coast from eastern Texas to southern Alabama. In the Carolinas, leaves emerged about a week later than normal this year, linked to a cold and snowy winter in the east. The process was also slower than normal in eastern Virginia by about 2 weeks in some spots. The stretch from Milwaukee to Detroit and Buffalo is on the verge of seeing spring leaves, several days ahead of its schedule. In Boston, first leaf typically occurs around April 3rd. It will probably be within a few days of that average for this year. Lilac and honeysuckle tend to bloom about a month after their leaves come out. Right now, that's happening from California to the Carolinas and Virginia, mostly well ahead of schedule. In the nation's capital, cherry blossoms can appear earlier than lilac and honeysuckle flowers because different species respond to heat differently. Cherries bloom before leafing, unlike those indicator plants. Meanwhile, in Death Valley, California, there's been a rare superbloom of wildflowers due to plentiful rain and warm conditions. The blooming of flowers is an important seasonal milestone for insects and other pollinators, which depend on pollen or nectar for food. It's also of great importance to farmers and other agricultural producers, wrote the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The agency added that, quote, if warm winters or springs cause early flowering in peach or other fruit trees, it can make them especially vulnerable to damage from a single late season frost or freeze. In North Carolina, where flowers recently bloomed, weather documentarian Mark Sudeth described clouds of pollen wafting through the air last week. It was the worst he could recall, he said, covering his car mere hours that had just been washed. Following recent abnormal heat and record spring growth, spells of unseasonably cold conditions are expected across the Intermountain West and plains this week and weekend, along with accumulating snow in some areas. Crimmins said that frost typically isn't devastating to leaves, but it can set them back a few weeks. She added that new research suggests that the setback can extend into the following year, resulting in delayed growth activity. However, she mentioned that a higher impact is typically seen when flower tissues are damaged by frost because they don't usually regenerate in the same season. Cherry and plum trees flower before they show their leaves, which means the flowers are the first parts to get exposed to potentially damaging conditions. If all the blooms are damaged in one event, that can mean little to no chance for fruit production. Quote, we've seen massive crop losses in recent years when this combination of events has occurred, end quote, Crimmins said. Large swaths of the United States, from the west to the southern plains, experienced their warmest March on record, considering average temperatures. Parts of the southwest had temperatures that were more than 15 degrees above average for the month. Only small portions of northern Minnesota, North Dakota, and Washington state experienced below average temperatures. The rest of the country was warmer than average. This will probably culminate in the warmest March on record for this country, and one of the warmest months compared with the average overall since at least 1981. Since then, just two other months featured temperature departures from average of around 7 degrees in the United States, March 2012 and January 2006. Such large deviations from the norm in temperatures, leaf emergence, and flower blooms are becoming more frequent as our climate continues to rise. Our next article is from the opinion page, and it was written by Max Boot. Hegseth's firing of a top general is the latest sign of Pentagon turmoil. In the early morning hours of February 28th, President Donald Trump announced the biggest U.S. war in more than two decades. What was Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth doing the day before? Announcing a settlement with Scouting America, formerly known as the Boy Scouts of America, to discontinue some diversity initiatives. Hegseth did not succeed in getting the group to kick out girls or revert to its earlier name, but he did convince it to end its Citizenship in Society merit badge, earned by scouts who, quote, realize the benefits of diversity, equity, inclusion, and ethical leadership. It's hard to imagine a better symbol of where Hegseth's priorities lie. He's more focused on fighting culture wars than actual wars. Hence, his decision on Thursday to fire General Randy George, the Army Chief of Staff, and two other senior Army generals amid preparations for a possible ground incursion into Iran. I have long known and admired George. He is an outstanding professional who has done much to help bring the Army into the drone era of military conflict. No less an eminence than retired General Barry McCaffrey, who compiled a legendary combat record from the Vietnam War to the Gulf War, wrote on X that George is, quote, possibly the best leader I have ever encountered in a uniform. Integrity, experienced combat leader, solid judgment, courage, modesty, takes care of soldiers. So why fire George? As usual, no reason was given. But I'm told by an Army officer that Hegseth had long been suspicious of George, who had previously worked for Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. In the past year, George has become close colleagues with Army Secretary Dan Driscoll, who was a Hegseth rival. Most recently, George and Driscoll have clashed with Hegseth over his demand to remove two women and two members of minorities from the Army's promotion list to Brigadier General. George had requested a meeting with Hegseth to defend the decisions of the Army Promotion Board. Hegseth refused to see him and instead cashiered him. George's replacement, General Christopher Leneve, is Hegseth's former military assistant. The Army officer I spoke with said Leneve is not well qualified for this post and doesn't have a great reputation. CNN reports that Leneve won the White House's favor after Trump's inauguration last year with a video call from South Korea to the Commander-in-Chief Ball. Leneve, backed by about 40 members of his staff, congratulated Trump on his election victory and said, "Welcome back, Mr. President." Trump gushed, "Is this man central casting or what?" If there were a political dimension to the Hegseth's sudden change in Army leadership, it wouldn't be surprising. He has consistently pursued the MAGA agenda at the cost of politicizing the armed forces. Last week, he squashed an Army investigation into an incident when two Apache helicopters hovered in front of the estate of Trump supporter Kid Rock near Nashville. "No punishment, no investigation. Carry on, patriots," Hegseth wrote on a social media. Would he have been as cavalier about flight safety if the pilots were honoring Bruce Springsteen or some other Trump critic? In a similar vein, Hegseth banned officers from attending courses or taking fellowships at 24 elite university and think tanks, all of which he labeled woke. Hegseth wants to reroute officers to avowedly conservative institutions such as Hillsdale College and Liberty University. He also tried to kick the mainstream press corps out of the Pentagon, replacing them with right-wing outlets, a move that a judge ruled unlawful. Yet another judge stepped in when Hegseth tried to punish Mark Kelly, a retired Navy captain and astronaut, now a U.S. senator, for telling troops in November not to obey illegal orders. But Hegseth's most corrosive actions have been to fire or sideline more than a dozen senior admirals and generals without making clear why. A disproportionate number of them appear to have been ethnic minorities or women. NBC News reports that Hegseth is also blocking the promotion of more than a dozen minority and female officers. "One African-American officer recently told me that members of minorities in the Pentagon feel as if they have targets on their back." If only Hegseth were as skilled and enthusiastic about waging the war with Iran as he is about his culture wars. His main contribution to the war effort seems to be his bombastic and belligerent news conferences, where his premature predictions of victory echo those of Baghdad Bob, Saddam Hussein's infamous propagandist. In one widely mocked moment, Hegseth insisted on March 13th regarding the Strait of Hormuz that, quote, "the only thing prohibiting transit right now is Iran shooting at shipping. It's open for transit. Should Iran not do that?" Hegseth has appeared to cast the campaign against the Islamic Republic as a holy war, praying at the Pentagon for U.S. troops to inflict, quote, "overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy, in the mighty and powerful name of Jesus Christ." Such remarks have led Pope Leo to speak out against what one Vatican official described as the exploitation of faith. Even more troubling is that, according to news reports, in the time run-up to the war, Hegseth downplayed the risks. Time magazine reports that Hegseth was, quote, "caught off guard," end quote, when Iran attacked other Persian Gulf states. Trump publicly admitted he was surprised by the extent of Iranian retaliation, which he should not have been if he had been properly briefed. Perhaps because Hegseth wasn't expecting Iran to put up much of a fight, he failed to take some elementary precautions. The Navy decommissioned its minesweepers stationed in Bahrain months before the war began. Hegseth ignored Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's offer to share Ukraine's drone defense technology. The Defense Department did not send ground forces to the region at the beginning of the conflict. They have only now arrived. U.S. forces had not built enough bunkers at vulnerable U.S. bases within missile and drone range of Iran before the campaign began. That led the Pentagon to put out an emergency request on March 23 for prefabricated transportable bunkers that could be rushed to the Middle East. Having retired many superb officers, Hegseth himself could wind up getting fired if Trump is looking for scapegoats for a war now markedly unpopular in the United States. But long after Hegseth is gone, the damage he has done to the armed forces with his purges and his culture wars will endure. In our second opinion piece, Ramesh Panora, Trump's Hall of Mirrors speech. Adolf Hitler, in a contemplative mood, said that every war at its start is like opening the door to a dark room. Not true in the case of the United States war with Iran, which has been more like entering a hall of mirrors. President Donald Trump's first extended speech about the war, delivered 32 days into it, did not provide a clearer picture. This is not the fog of war, it's the fog of Trump's rhetoric and perhaps his thoughts. Consider this abbreviated timeline. On March 1, he gave a short interview in which he seemed to change his mind about whether he wanted regime change in Iran. On March 6, he demanded unconditional surrender in all caps. On March 13, he said Iran had been, quote, totally defeated. On March 21, he said that the operation had achieved his objectives ahead of schedule. Although there has obviously been no surrender, with or without conditions, later that day, he said he would start hitting Iran's power plants, which would arguably be a war crime, unless the supposedly already defeated country let oil traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. The White House address on Wednesday provided more of the same dissonance. Quote, the war has already achieved its objective, so the United States will keep waging it, and it will end soon. Regime change, he said, was not his goal, but has happily occurred anyway, and he will keep bombing the new, much more reasonable Iranian leaders. The administration's most frequently stated objective, and the one Trump emphasized in his speech, was degrading Iran's military capabilities. The White House offers no criteria for assessing when that objective has been sufficiently met. Trump could have used his speech to announce that he is ending Operation Epic Fury. He said, after all, that Iran is, quote, no longer a threat. He could announce it tomorrow. He could have announced it on several yesterdays. Judging by an objective other than hurting Iran's military, though, stopping now would hardly count as a successful conclusion to the war. Iran's regime would have survived and been seen to have survived the, quote, epic fury of the United States. That regime would have shown that it could close and open the Strait of Hormuz at its discretion. Oil prices would be higher. The U.S. alliance with Europe has somehow weakened even further, and America's Persian Gulf allies would at least be disappointed. And 13 members of the U.S. military have been already killed. On the positive side of the ledger, the Iranian military would have indeed been degraded. But that's a reversible achievement unless the United States stands ready to launch future operations like this one, which the president keeps feeling the need to say will end very soon. All in all, America would be in a weaker position than when the war started. Yet stopping now or using force to open the Strait of Hormuz and then stopping still might be the best available option. The alternative of a true regime change war would require a large and extended commitment of U.S. troops to Iran. Many Americans have wanted to see the Iranian regime replaced. Trump's speech was most persuasive on that point, about which Americans least needed to be persuaded, that the regime has always been barbaric. But without boots on the ground. Instead of making a choice, the Trump administration appears to have hoped it would secure the end without the means. This war's lack of strategic clarity and consistent rhetoric owes a lot to the president's well-known character flaws, such as his impulsivity and dishonesty. It's also a price of his failure to abide by the Constitution. Even the most ardent advocate of presidential power during the founding, Alexander Hamilton, said it was up to Congress to transfer the nation from a state of peace to a state of war. If another country declared or waged war against the United States, a state of war would already exist, and the president could respond without Congress. Presidents have usually sought congressional approval for large-scale military operations, as George H.W. Bush did before the Persian Gulf War, and George W. Bush did before the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Going to Congress has a practical advantage that is often mentioned. It reduces the chance that the country will go to war without much support from the public. In this case, though, following the Constitution would have brought an even more basic benefit. Before it made its argument to Congress and the people, the administration would have had to figure out its objectives and how it planned to obtain them. The White House would have had to think through the operation more than it gives any evidence of having done, or, judging from Trump's speech, than it is doing still. Our next article is taking a look at theater. Safety Not Guaranteed and Shea Joey bring musical bliss to the D.C. area stages. There may be no more apt title for the uniquely maddening, innately risky venture that is crafting a new stage musical than Safety Not Guaranteed. As composer Ryan Miller pointed out this month during a speech on the show's opening night at Signature Theater in Arlington, musical theater ventures often devolve into years-long slogs that never yield a stageable production. The mere decision to embark on such an endeavor takes bravery and maybe a little insanity. To navigate all the meetings and readings and workshops necessary to mount a musical is a feat in fortitude. Finally, getting that show on stage requires exhaustive collaboration. So it's something of a marvel that two fairly new musicals, Safety Not Guaranteed at Signature and Shea Joey at Arena Stage, are dazzling on the D.C. area stages. The shows are undeniably different. Safety is an adaptation of a 2012 film that charmed the Sundance Film Festival. It is a sleek, one-act, indie rock musical about quirky loners wrestling with regret. Shea Joey, a radical reimagining of the 1940 musical Pal Joey, that does in fact bill itself as a new musical on the script's title page, is an entrancing song and dance spectacular powered by a couple of homegrown stars. Together, they speak to the form's unbridled breath. Though perfectly enjoyable, the Safety Not Guaranteed movie, written by Derek Conley and directed by Colin Trevorrow, was a tad slight. Avoiding the unwieldy imitation of many screen-to-stage adaptations, the Safety show feels like the inevitable endpoint for material that greatly benefited from adding librettist Nick Blamire's deft writing and Miller's stirring songs. Now, once flimsy character moments and plot beats stand straight. The show's skeleton still resembles the movie. When a slacker magazine writer spots a classified ad from someone searching for a time travel partner, he enlists a couple of interns for a road trip to track down the guy. But his intern, Darius, a revelatory Mia Park, forges a bond with that standoffish oddball, Kenneth, played by Gunnar Manchester, a sweet tale of outsider camaraderie unfolds. I didn't catch the show's 2024 world premiere, which gleaned mixed reviews at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Whatever kinks played that iteration, the Signature mounting seems to have mended them. Featuring a new director, Oliver Butler, and a fresh cast, this production turns both the Darius-Kenneth relationship and middle-aged journalist Jeff's, played by Preston Truman Boyd, reunion with high school fling, played by Aaron Weaver, into moving reflections on that universal desire to relive the past and correct mistakes of old. Along the way, the ethereal head-bobbing songs from Guster, singer-songwriter Miller, offer reliable jolts, particularly the shot-out-of-a-cannon opener known as Architects and Engineers, the wrenching showstopper, Chocolate Milk, and the rousing finale, One Man Wrecking Machine. Shea Joey, meanwhile, takes its cues from Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart's musical, Pal Joey. For the unfamiliar, Hart was Rodgers' pre-Oscar Hammerstein collaborator, expertly portrayed by Ethan Hawke in the film Blue Moon. Yet book writer Richard LeGravenny so comprehensively transformed the show that it's not billed as a revival. Although some tunes from Pal Joey endure, Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered wasn't going anywhere. This version is more of a Rodgers and Hart jukebox musical peppered with standards as The Lady is a Tramp from Babes in Arms and This Can't Be Love from The Boys from Syracuse. Co-directed by actor Tony Goldwyn and visionary choreographer Savion Glover, Shea Joey is the rare conceptual overhaul that so snugly fits the material that you labor to imagine it being done any other way. By changing Joey, Tony winner Miles Frost, to a black character and setting this tale in 1940 Bronzeville, a Southside Chicago neighborhood known as Black Metropolis, LeGravenny's and his collaborators shrewdly upped the ante. Now Joey's climb from a spotlight-craving MC to a nightclub-running impresario is anchored in a thorny negotiation of black artistry and ownership. When I attended last month's opening night performance, Shea Joey did stumble through some Act One pacing issues. The plot takes too long to coalesce and the occasional superfluous number. But after local standout Awa Sal Seka steals the first act with staggering rendition of Where's That Rainbow Bow and My Funny Valentine, Frost, a Silver Spring native, hypnotically taps and slides and splits his way to many a well-deserved ovation after the intermission. Of course, success stories wouldn't hit the same if we didn't all get noble misfires. Take Little Miss Perfect, Jiraiya Kwame's new musical that recently wrapped its run at the Olney Theater Center. Born out of TikTok fame, the world premiere was a diverting enough production, buoyed by some catchy tunes and winning performances. Leanne J. Antonio, Mia Goodman, and Graciela Ray are talents to watch. Still, the road from online virality to onstage reality was a bumpy one for a show that too often turns to tropes and overstuffs the songbook. So let's relish the two triumphs still running on area stages as the unicorns that they are. If there's one thing for certain in musical theater, it's that nothing is guaranteed. Once again, from the world of entertainment and style, Celine Dion announces comeback shows 4 years after the diagnosis of a rare condition. It's been 6 years since Celine Dion's last full concert, but that's about to change. Dion, who turned 58 on Monday, plans to perform a set of 10 concerts this fall at the Paris La Défense Arena in a video posted to her social media accounts. She spoke about the shows across September and October, along with providing an update on her health. Quote, "Over these last few years, every day that's gone by, I felt your prayers and support, your kindness and your love," Dion said. "Even in my most difficult times, you were there for me. You've helped me in ways that I can't even describe, and I'm truly fortunate to have your support." The announcement was teased on posters around the French capital, adorned with the titles of Dion's songs, including My Heart Will Go On and Pourquoi Tu M'aimes Encore. A countdown to the announcement appeared on a giant screen below the Eiffel Tower, which erupted into a light show paired with Dion's song I'm Alive, while an early morning dry run for the extravagant display read Celine Dion, Paris, I Am Ready, in French, according to the television network BFM-TV. When the tickets go on sale on April 10th, they are likely to be a hot commodity. The 200,000 available tickets for the Paris dates of Dion's Courage World Tour sold out in 90 minutes when they went on sale in 2019, according to the Deadlines. While the COVID pandemic forced Dion to reschedule the latter half of her Courage World Tour, she's been sidelined from performing after being diagnosed with a rare and incurable neurological condition known as stiff person syndrome. She shared the news in 2022 after canceling the rescheduled tour dates. This disorder causes muscle stiffness and intense muscle spasm in the trunk and the limbs. It can affect posture, balance, and the ability to use certain muscles, making it difficult for some patients to walk. Just imagine having the worst Charlie horse you can have, but it's affecting a ton of muscles in your lower back and your legs, and it's constant, Kunal Desai, assistant professor of neurology at Yale University, told the Washington Post. But stiff person syndrome doesn't typically harm longevity, making it possible for patients to lead a normal life with symptom management. Since her diagnosis, Dion has performed at the 2024 Paris Olympics opening ceremonies with an assured rendition of Edith Piaf's Hymne à l'amour from the Eiffel Tower. Months earlier, Dion made an appearance at the Grammy Awards as a presenter. Quote, "When I say that I'm happy to be here, I really mean it from my heart," Dion told the Grammy audience. "Those who have been blessed enough to be here must never take for granted the tremendous love and joy that music brings to our lives and to people all around the world." After becoming a star as a teenager in her native Canada throughout the 80s, Dion started receiving broad recognition by winning the 1988 Eurovision Song Contest and recorded smash albums in English. Her American breakthrough came with the synth-based Where Does My Heart Beat Now, which reached the top five of the Billboard Hot 100 chart. Through the 90s, Dion remained inescapable on pop radio, whether that was with her Titanic theme, My Heart Will Go On, or the bubbling The Power of Love. Even with her smash hits, she continued making music in French, including 1995's Dieu, the best-selling French-language album worldwide ever. Her struggle with stiff person syndrome were chronicled in I Am Celine Dion, a documentary from Academy Award nominee Irene Taylor. During interviews in her Las Vegas mansion, Dion revealed that she had struggled with vocal spasms and her ability to walk for nearly two decades. But she said she was determined to return to the stage. "If I can't run, I'll walk," she said. "And if I can't walk, I'll crawl. But I won't stop." Virginians deeply divided on Spanberger months after her landslide win. Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger's approval rating stands at 47% 2 months into the Democrats' term, with 46% of voters disapproving and 7% expressing no opinion in a Washington Post Schar School report. Spanberger won in a 15-point landslide last year after touting her reputation for bipartisanship built on 3 terms representing a conservative-leaning district in Congress. But her current ratings reflect a sharp polarization among Virginia voters in their views of the state's first female governor. The approval mark for Spanberger is a 13% points lower than the average for Virginia governors in post-polling since the 90s. Her near-even split between approval and disapproval is a worse net approval rating than the early term scores of her predecessors in previous post-polls. It is also slightly weaker than ratings of her immediate predecessor, Glenn Youngkin, Republican, in a post-Shar school poll last fall, showing he ended his term with 50% approval and 46% disapproval. Unlike Spanberger, Youngkin had come into office with a very narrow victory. And a positive sign for Spanberger, elements of her affordability agenda score well with voters, suggesting room to improve her image after a rocky start. The governor also continues to be more popular than President Donald Trump among Virginia voters, 40% of whom approve of his performance, while 57% disapprove. A larger share of voters expressed strong disapproval of Spanberger's performance than of her predecessors. 2/3 say they either strongly approve at 29% or strongly disapprove at 38%. Fewer than 6 in 10 felt strongly about Youngkin's performance at any point in his tenure, with 28% strongly approving and 25% strongly disapproving in post-Shar polling last September. Some amounts of polarization is baked in, but this is unusual at this early stage of her administration, and given that she has long cultivated a centrist image, said Mark Roselle, dean of George Mason University's Shar School of Policy and Government, which co-sponsored this poll. She has maintained the support of her Democratic base. More than 8 in 10 Democrats approve of her performance. Spanberger has not made inroads with Republicans, nearly 9 in 10 of whom disapprove. In addition, Spanberger gets more strong disapproval from Republicans at 78% than strong approval from Democrats at 62%. The independent voters are split, with 45% approving, 46% disapproving of Spanberger. Last fall, she won 59% of independent voters, according to the network, exiting polls. Thank you so much for listening. It appears that that's all the time that we have. I look forward to another opportunity to read the Washington Post to you, and may you have a good day.